Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Edward McBride, finance editor of The Economist, and this is Money Talks. This week, we'll be asking Ryan Avent, our free exchange columnist, about what economics can tell us about gun violence in America.
It seems like there is an increasingly clear relationship between the rate of gun ownership in an area and the amount of gun violence that we see.
And Simon Rabinovich, our Asia economics editor, will be taking us to the epicenter of China's banking black market.
Because Wenzhou was effectively standing alone, the Wenzhou networks of households, of factories and businesses came up with their own solution to financing.
First, America has been reeling from events in Orlando this weekend.
On Sunday, Americans woke up to a nightmare that's become mind-numbingly familiar.
A horrific massacre of dozens of innocent people.
The worst mass shooting in our country's history.
We know enough to say that this was an act of terror and an act of hate.
The largest mass shooting in American history has further inflamed the ferocious debate over gun control in America, which is underpinned by deep political and cultural divides. But what can economics tell us about America's gun control impasse? I'm joined by Ryan Avent, our free exchange columnist, who's been writing about the economics of gun control in America. So, Ryan, America has far more guns than any other rich country and far more gun violence. Is that right?
That is right. As far as rich countries go, America is just an extraordinary outlier on both counts. There is slightly more than one gun per person in America, which is several times larger than the next country down the line, which is Switzerland. Perhaps not coincidentally, the level of gun violence in America is also an outlier by the standards of the industrialized world. In 2012, America had about 30 gun homicides per million people. To give you a point of comparison, Australia had about 1.4 per million people. And obviously, gun homicides aren't the way that people suffer at the hands of guns. Suicides by gun are much higher in America than elsewhere, as are accidents.
And so all of this obviously has an incredible human cost, many lives lost, many lives ruined. But presumably it also has an enormous economic cost. What does the research tell us about that?
Well, the human cost is substantial. It's about 32,000 people killed per year. That figure just surpassed the number of Americans killed in car accidents. It's difficult to put a precise figure on the cost of gun violence. One estimate in 2012 put the number at about $300 billion. And academics which have tried to sort of assign the social cost of gun violence to each gun have said that if we were going to incorporate that cost into the purchase, it would raise gun prices by as much as $1,800. So the economic effect of these guns is just enormous.
But of course, gun rights activists in America say that the solution to criminals with guns is to have more law-abiding citizens with guns, that guns are a deterrent to crime. Then, of course, gun control advocates say the opposite, that if you took guns out of everybody's hands, the society would be safer. Is there good evidence to support one side or the other of that argument?
Increasingly, there is, but it's a much harder thing to kind of adjudicate than you would imagine. If you were to put together a chart that had the number of guns in a country on one axis and gun violence on the other, you get a very clear correlation between the two, and it would seem like the connection is obvious. But when people try to dig into the numbers to really establish the causation, it becomes more complicated. As gun rights advocates argue, it could be that people are buying more guns in response to high crime levels in order to protect themselves. But over the last sort of 15 to 20 years, as researchers have dug into the questions and tried to use more fine-grained data and natural experiments involving kind of when gun control laws are passed at local levels, it seems like there is an increasingly clear relationship between the rate of gun ownership in an area and the amount of gun violence that we see.
So if, as you say, the evidence has become clearer that more guns do indeed lead to more gun violence, then you would expect there to be political pressure in America to adopt some kind of stricter controls on the sales of guns. And indeed, most polls show that a majority of Americans are in favor of that. So why does that not happen in spite the terrible persistence of massacres like the one that took place in Orlando?
It boils down to two things, really. One is just the political economy of the issue, which is that you have a majority that is in favor of gun control, but at kind of a low intensity level, that it's an issue that they care about, but they also care about lots of other issues. On the other hand, gun rights activists have a very high kind of preference intensity. They feel very strongly about this issue to the exclusion of almost all else. And that imbalance is especially nasty in America because of the ways in which the U.S. political system enables minorities within Congress to have outsized power. So after the Sandy Hook massacre in 2013, there was a bill that was sponsored by both a Democrat and a Republican to adopt background checks in almost all gun purchases. This measure received a majority of votes in the Senate, but it nonetheless didn't move forward because the majority wasn't big enough to get over this procedural threshold. So the two of those things combined really make it difficult to get anything done.
So one of the reasons that, measures like the one you just described seem so often to go down to defeat in America's Congress is that they're portrayed as the thin end of the wedge, the first step in a secret government plan to take everyone's guns away of every description, even from law-abiding citizens, even ones that have gone through background checks and so on. What would it take to significantly reduce gun violence? I mean, would the worst fears of the NRA have to be realized and everyone's weapons confiscated?
I think if you wanted to move American rates of gun violence to a level like that in another rich country, it would take quite substantial gun control measures. Australia passed sweeping measures after 1996 that banned assault weapons, banned certain kinds of powerful shotguns, which made it much harder to get a license to own a gun, which led to buybacks of millions of guns and had quite substantial effects on gun crime as a result. But I do think that the evidence suggests that even smaller measures can have a meaningful effect. Every little bit helps, I think.
Ryan Avent, thank you very much. Let us know what you think by tweeting us at Economist Radio or emailing radio@economist.com. Now, China's economy has long been a little murky. From secretive state-owned firms to suspect statistics, good information has always been a little elusive. But there's one place in particular, the remote port city of Wenzhou, that's even harder to make sense of, but has nevertheless become a central character in the ongoing drama of Chinese finance. Simon Rabinovich, our Asia Economics Editor, joins me now from Shanghai. Simon, what makes Wenzhou so unique?
So Wenzhou is a city in eastern China, and it's always stood apart from the rest of China for a variety of reasons. Geographically, it's relatively isolated. It's a coastal city, but it's ringed by mountains on the land side. Linguistically, the Wenzhou dialect is basically not understood by anybody else in China. And so it's always been its own place. It's always been sort of one of the most aggressive marketplaces in China.
And so these special conditions, what sort of financial institution was allowed to thrive there as a result?
Because Wenzhou was effectively standing alone, the Wenzhou networks of households, of factories and businesses came up with their own solution to financing. They backed each other. And so Wenzhou was really at the origins of shadow banking in China. Eventually, the networks got quite a lot bigger. But so long as you were from Wenzhou, you were seen as being inside that trust circle.
And so can you give us a sense of scale? I mean, how big do these sort of informal credit work networks, these shadow banks, how big have they become in Wenzhou and in China as a whole?
So, I mean, by its very nature, it's hard to be precise about the exact side of shadow banking. If you estimate it from different angles, the conclusion these days is that it's probably equivalent to about two-thirds of GDP nationally. In Wenzhou, before it ran into its problems in 2011 when it had its own kind of financial crisis, it was even bigger. It was probably bigger than the overall city's GDP.
And so what happened when things got rough, when the tumbling started?
In the early 2000s, Wenzhouese, the business people, began to fan out around the country, supported by money from their hometown. And they began to get into more speculative forms of business, whether it was playing the stock market or investing in property. And they were very, very leveraged. And that worked well for a time. Fast forward to 2010, 2011, China began to tighten its monetary policy coming out of its big stimulus after the financial crisis. And because the Wenzhouese were the most over-leveraged people and business people in China, they were also the first to really bear the brunt of that tightening. So you began to have a series of defaults. And because the financial system was so shadowy and so opaque, you had these long, long chains of debt financing that were ultimately very, very difficult to unpick. And so what might have been a concentrated crisis for sort of the most speculative of Wenzhou's investors spread throughout the city. So it was a really, really abrupt change of fortune for Wenzhou and for the Wenzhou's.
And so where are we now? I mean, with that complicated unraveling that you mentioned.
5 years on, the city is still slowly picking up the pieces from that. There's been a big, big effort from the central government to bring the shadow banking into the sunlight, is how they often describe it. There's also been a big effort with bankruptcy law in Wenzhou, because so many businesses got into trouble. There was this question of how could you begin to restructure them. Bankruptcy law is something which is really in its infancy in China. And Wenzhou, you know, having been at the forefront of experimenting with private sector-led development in the 1980s and 1990s, is now at the forefront with experimenting with bankruptcy law and restructuring. If you look at the growth in Wenzhou, it's begun to pick up a little bit. Property prices have also been turning up, but they're still about 40 to 30% roughly below their peak 5 years ago. So they still have a long, long way to go to get back to where they once were.
And so what's the moral of this for China more broadly, both in terms of, you know, when China's debt mountain might actually cause a crisis, and in terms of how China might recover from such a crisis if it happens?
Because Wenzhou is an extreme case, problems in China will not exactly parallel the problems in Wenzhou, but in small, it's a preview of the kinds of problems that would probably arise if China continues to let debt build up as it has been doing for several years now. That's you know, while things are still on the upside. Eventually, when things, you know, come to the downside, when growth slows more sharply, when the debt problems begin to emerge, I think Wenzhou is an example of how the government has to be bolder initially in dealing with the problems. I mean, here we are 5 years on, and they're finally talking about bankruptcy and restructuring in Wenzhou. If they had done that in 2012, 2013, the recovery in Wenzhou probably would have been a lot quicker. I think just one final note of warning, if you will, as difficult as it has been for Wenzhou to recover, ultimately, it's one city. It's a city of 10 million people. If you have bigger cities, bigger provinces running into problems without a similar sized country around them to support them, then I think the overall recovery story becomes one that potentially is even longer and more protracted.
Simon Rabinovich, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That's it for Money Talks this week. Goodbye.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.